This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. There will be at least one job opening in Miami-Dade government that presumably will be filled despite the budget battle underway over spending and jobs. Lisa Martinez, Chief of Staff for Mayor Carlos Jimenez, is resigning, we learned today. She had been in the position for only 5 months. She plans on leaving by August 1st. Her resignation comes the same week her boss proposed a $6.2 billion budget to run Miami-Dade County government in the next fiscal year. It's money for police and fire departments, money for trains and buses, for parks and ports, libraries and lawyers. The mayor calls his budget proposal a worst-case scenario. If approved, it would leave the county's property tax rate unchanged, but 674 jobs, which almost half coming from jobs would be cut, with almost half of those cuts coming from the county's largest department, the police department.
On a worst case scenario, yes, there will have to be some layoffs of police officers, but we are going to have the same number of police officers in the streets of Miami-Dade County that we have today.
That was the mayor this week speaking with the Miami Herald editorial board. Earlier this week, president of the Miami-Dade Police Benevolent Association, John Rivera, told WSVN television, if the mayor's plan goes through, his recommendation is, quote, either buy yourself an attack dog, put bars on your windows and doors, and get yourself some firearms because you're going to have to protect yourselves, end quote.
Irresponsible comments that say, you know, bar your windows, buy guns, okay, is completely irresponsible. We're going to have the same number of police officers responding to emergency calls. Your response times aren't going to change.
The job cuts, though, proposed as they are, go well beyond the police department. They would also hit the libraries. Staffing in Miami-Dade County libraries would shrink by 20% under the mayor's plan. Now, prior to the budget release this week, president of Friends of the Miami-Dade Public Libraries, John Quick, was hoping that after a few years of budget cuts, funding would grow again.
It would be to restore and enhance the library system to where it was and where it needs to be. And what that means is that it's open in the hours it needs to be open, and it would give us the programming that the library has been come to known for, you know, early childhood literacy programs, adult literacy programs, as well as enhanced programming for digital media type of education and things like that.
But library supporters were disappointed. The mayor's budget further cuts library spending for at least the third year in a row. Here on the Florida Roundup, to begin with the Miami-Dade County budget, Patty Mazzei covering County Hall, for the Miami Herald, Steve Rothaus for the Miami Herald, and Mike Mayo, South Florida Sun Sentinel columnist. All of you, welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Patty, let's begin, first of all, with the personnel move that we learned about early on Friday morning, the chief of staff resignation. Anything related to the budget battle underway?
It doesn't sound like it from Lisa Martinez's resignation letter. She cites wanting to go back to the world of nonprofits and working with children and families as her reason for leaving the county after 3 years, but she's only been chief of staff for 5 months, and certainly her resignation in the middle of budget season is, you know, bad timing politically, though she said she is staying, you know, till around the end of July or so.
So presumably the budget battle, at least perhaps the most heated parts of the budget battle, will have subsided by the time she leaves the office.
Well, we won't have any votes until September, but next week is the big vote on setting the maximum property tax rate.
Let's talk about the spreadsheet. Let's pull out the spreadsheets here, the budgets. Steve and Mike, we've got to run through all of these gritty details here because this is where the rubber meets the road, Patty. $64 million deficit. That's been the big number in the room for the mayor to try to fill that void. Where does it come from?
Well, the way he proposed this budget, which is assuming that he's not going to get any further concessions from labor unions, those cuts are coming from public services and layoffs. And that's, as you mentioned, a big part of the police and corrections budget. They're funded by general fund dollars, which, not to get too technical, is just a big part of what property taxes pay for. So we're seeing this big number of positions being eliminated, 674 across the county.
Do we know how many of those are actually filled positions today versus just vacant positions that'll be eliminated?
We don't have a total on that just yet, but a lot of the ones in the police department are filled. And a lot of them may not be street patrol officers, as the mayor said, but they certainly are investigative officers who are kind of behind the scenes, you know, with their hands on case files.
Here's my question as the outsider, because I'm obviously based up in Broward and cover stuff up there in Palm Beach counties, and we're not getting the same kind of noise in terms of, oh, there's doom and gloom, and actually it's the opposite. There's an economic and real estate recovery underway, a lot of new construction, and I see a lot of new buildings down here. How is this happening down here? because in Broward, the things are growing again, and again, they're able to hold the line on the millage rates and the tax collections while not cutting any services.
I think we've seen like these extreme pendulum swings in Miami-Dade, and we're still just not in a place where they are stable because we had, you know, a big increase in the property tax rate during the previous mayor, Carlos Alvarez. He gets recalled, the new mayor comes in, undoes the whole thing, and writes up these new contracts for 3 years with a bunch of concessions that are now expiring. And the political climate, he says, is not ready for a property tax rate, but the county is still funding a bunch of things from before that he says they can't afford anymore. And that's why we keep seeing this turmoil. I mean, like you said, the property values have gone up, and you see the city of Miami, for example, proposing new spending without raising the tax rate. What the county says is, well, during the recession, they declared fiscal urgency several times in order not to fulfill their labor obligations. And we have had these concessions just creeping back up, and here we are.
And Steve Rothaus, you know, the mayor continues to go back to the public. Miami-Dade County property owners are not prepared to pay more in taxes. And so he's got to fill the deficit between the spending obligations that have been made, both in his administration and others, with what he contends are the ability of property owners and the willingness of property owners to pay those numbers.
Well, property owners have never wanted to pay more taxes. I mean, we're talking about Florida. We're talking about South Florida, Miami-Dade County, where people want to pay the minimum, yet they require and demand the maximum in services.
And to me, you know, what the larger point that a lot of times people don't understand is there are these various pieces of the pie. There's property taxes, and then there's tourist taxes. And obviously, we always like to raise tourist taxes because it's the old adage, don't tax you, don't tax me, tax the man behind the tree, or in this case, the guy coming in from Europe or South America.
The tourist who doesn't vote.
Those monies, the tourist monies, which are collected by the hotels and the rental cars, they go towards the sports teams. So that's why we have this glut of funding where you have us subsidizing the Heat and the Marlins, and now, well, it looks like David Beckham has taken his ball and going up north to Broward now. But
But Patty Mazzei with the Miami Herald, I mean, your investigations into Miami-Dade County spending has found the mayor previously has diverted some of those hotel taxes for other obligations, for other funding mechanisms.
Yes, and this is one of the big criticisms, I think, against not just this mayor, but just in general in previous county administrations, too, that they move money around and they find money for different things. And that's why the unions repeatedly use the argument that, well, we don't know if we can trust what you're telling us.
Right.
This year, the budget hole started at $208 million. Now it's down to $64 million. That's generally considered a good thing, but because it's a moving target, that just doesn't engender a lot of trust from people.
And this does get down to labor negotiations. The mayor made this point over and over this week that this is the worst case scenario. He's assuming that the negotiators are unable to get labor unions to continue the temporary concessions on pay and health benefits that they agreed to several years ago. What is on the table? What do we know about those concessions? And if there is no New Deal, what happens in October when those concessions go away?
So on October 1st, if we don't have new contracts, then a bunch of the pay benefits snap back is the term of art. And that means that things that the county has not been paying for 3 years, they're known as flex pay, premium pay, which is basically perks for the employees.
Overtime pay, vacation.
They get paid overtime and vacation. These are additional negotiated benefits would come back. That represents $40 million a year for the county just in those snapbacks. The mayor would like new three-year contracts that don't have any of these benefits and that reduce the healthcare benefits for the employees as well.
And Patty, I've got a question. I mean, we hear talk about how property values have all come back, but have they all come back, or are we talking about parts of the county specifically that have had, you know, a big comeback and big building boom, particularly the city of Miami along the Biscayne Boulevard Brickell corridor? But what about the rest of the county? Have the property values come back to the point where they can, you know, basically fund these kinds of services?
They've come back on average an increase this year of 6.8%, but you're right, they have not come back evenly. And so that's why you see like the city of Miami doing very well. They have the building boom from downtown, right. But there's part of unincorporated Dade County portions of the South and West that are just not doing as well.
And the other thing to remember is there's a big time lag between what the assessed property value, which is what the tax rate is, is collecting from, and what the real time market value is. Because I know, like, my neighborhood houses are selling again at pretty good dollars, but our assessment rates are still pretty low. So because the property appraisers by law have to set it based on January 1st of a given year, and even that is those valuations are usually done in June. So it's a big time lag.
We're talking about the revenue side for municipal government, the income, so to speak, and the levers that any administration, any county commissioner can pull on in terms of the income are relatively limited, Patty. I mean, it gets down to the millage rate, essentially, or
that
other,
dreaded word,
other special millage. Other special, you know, tax rates that are in certain districts. When it comes to the spending side, that's where there are a multiple of levers to pull on, and the mayor here is pulling significantly on the labor level to try to continue with the concessions that were put into place during economic hard times here in the county. What kind of success rate does he anticipate to have compared to the position he staked out versus what he may wind up accepting?
Well, he has already taken back his initial gambit to reduce everybody's salaries by 10% across the board, because that really was not going to go anywhere. And the problem is for the mayor is that he's not as powerful as he was when he was first elected in 2011 and he got all of these concessions. Right now we have a commission that has bucked him several times on labor issues. They don't want to see employees keep kind of bearing the brunt of this. But the mayor is unwilling to raise the tax rate. He said he would probably veto any proposed increase depending on the commission votes on Tuesday. And so that does limit your levers, like you said, to service cuts and layoffs.
And those service cuts certainly go beyond just the job cuts that have been proposed in here. You're talking about reduced zoo hours, for instance. I mean, some of these...
Raising
transit rates, exactly. Some of these are really pocketbook issues that are going to affect residents across the county, not just in the high-dollar rent districts in Biscayne Boulevard and on the waterfront.
And increased transit fares, which the mayor says he doesn't want to do, would come for the second year in a row, another 25-cent increase. So every bus or metro rail trip would cost $2.50, and that disproportionately affects the poor. So there are not across-the-board fee hikes for everybody, but we are seeing a lot of proposals cutting back 311 hours for telephone assistance, mm-hmm. New fees in parks, reduced hours at the zoo, as you said. So there's a lot of trimming and cutting in different places.
And also libraries is a big part of this, Steve Rothaus.
Well, I mean, I know that we've reported that there's been a poll done recently by the Knight Foundation that 80% of likely voters would like to, you know, keep the funding, I believe, for the library.
That's right. 80%.
Well, they say they like the libraries. Right. They're not willing to pay higher taxes for it.
Well, and do they use the libraries?
Only 13% are willing to pay higher taxes for it.
But I'm just curious. I mean, what were the percentage of people who said they actually used the libraries and used the services that are available? Are they taking out books? What are they doing?
It was 70%. And I just happened to come from another appearance with somebody who was with the Knight Foundation who conducted this survey and had a chance to chat with her. And basically, there are 70% of people who still use libraries, some of them infrequently. But, you know, I think libraries are not obsolete. I have an 8-year-old girl, and I love taking her to my local branch of the library. Even though we have computers and we're fully wired and we can get all the content and information she needs, she likes going there to do her homework. It's a quiet spot, and I want to imbue that in her of a public shared spot to kind of come together and just roam through the books and look at the DVDs. And I love libraries. I grew up in New York where we had some huge...
But I don't think anybody would ever say they don't like their libraries, and previous surveys have also showed that people actually use them to take out books, right. Not for any other, you know, new technological... purpose. But what this the Knight Foundation did not highlight in its poll is that they do not have a majority of support to raise the tax rate.
Right.
So how do you do this? People want the service, but they don't want to pay for it. And repeatedly, we've seen that in polls from libraries.
Libraries, again, though, are a big kind of a headline here, Patty. It is something that the community rallied around a year ago. We certainly saw the county commission and the mayor work and jump through hoops to try to fill the library deficit. But again, to Steve Rothaus, to your point earlier, how much are residents willing to pay for the services that they get? Do they value the services that they get at the dollar cost that it is going to cost them to receive it at the level that they've come to expect?
And you know, that remains to be seen with the libraries. I mean, we know that people, I mean, I have a library card. When was the last time I went to the library and used it for anything in the library? The last time I've been to my library was to go to vote. But, I mean, seriously, you know, would I like to see the libraries shut down or cut back? Of course not. I mean, I grew up using libraries. And if I had children, perhaps I would be taking them there.
In many poorer communities, libraries are essentially become kind of de facto daycare centers or aftercare centers. A lot of kids go there and are on the computers. And, you know, is that right or wrong? I don't know, but it's nice that they're there. And I use libraries. I'm cheap. I don't belong to Netflix. I go to my library and I catch up on my movies. I just rented the last 2 weeks. I got to finally see the Matt McConaughey, his Academy Award winning performance, and I forgot the name.
The Buyer's Club.
Yes.
Mike Mayo is frugal.
Old.
He's not cheap here.
With a plug for the Broward Library System.
Absolutely right. Yes. The poll in Miami-Dade County, commissioned by the Greater Miami Chamber of Commerce, with support from the Knight Foundation, 80% oppose a significant cut to the library budget. 13% support it. So certainly there is a lot of
the problem
vocal
here
support.
Is they're not cutting. I mean, what they used reserves last year.
Right.
Those have gone away.
Can I
that
break
money
in?
Is gone. So
first of all, I'm amazed. It's 23 minutes into a live radio show in Miami. We've not uttered the words LeBron James, but I'm just monitoring the Twitterverse.
Well, you just broke it for us.
And Sports
Thanks,
Illustrated
Mike.
Is reporting that he's going back to the Cleveland Cavaliers. This is according to Sports Illustrated.
All right. We will leave it there here for this moment. Patty Mazzei covering County Hall for us and the
Can't
Miami Herald.
With LeBron.
Thanks, Patty. So much still to come on the Florida Roundup. Florida prisons under growing pressure of prisoner abuse and guard corruption investigations. This is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Outraged and appalled. This is how the Florida Department of Corrections Secretary Mike Crewe described his reaction to allegations of prisoner abuse at the Dade Correctional Institution. One of those cases involved Darren Rainey. He was 50 years old in June of 2012. He died in a scalding hot shower. He was locked in that shower as a form of punishment. This week, the warden at the facility, Jerry Cummins, was put on administrative leave.
Let me be very clear. There is zero tolerance for corruption or abuse in the Department of Corrections. We simply are not going to put up with this type of activity. We will root out any and all bad actors who do not live up to the expectations that we have and the responsibilities that we have in this agency.
This personnel action follows a whistleblower lawsuit filed earlier this week by four investigators against the Department of Corrections here in the state of Florida. This lawsuit claims that prisoners have been beaten and tortured, guards smuggled drugs and other contraband into the prisons, and the system covers up the activity. Do you have experience with prisons? You, a family member, a friend, perhaps? Do you work, maybe volunteer in a prison? Let us know what your experience is with the Department of Corrections at 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576, or send us a tweet using the call sign at WLRN. And a live blog ongoing right now with an online discussion on our website at WLRN.org. Joining us now on the Florida Roundup, Casey Frank with the Miami Herald, Steve Rothaus with the Herald, and Mike Mayo continues with the South Florida Sun-Sentinel. Casey, you worked on the series of stories that the Herald broke involving Darren Rainey's death, the death that led to the DCI, the Dade Correctional Institution, administrative leave for the warden this week. Who was Rainey?
Who was Rainey? He was a man who lived a troubled life. He was in and out of jail, or prison rather, for years and years. But there was nothing really in his record of a violent nature. He had a drug problem, and he was mentally ill. And he bounced back and forth between the streets and the prison for more than a decade.
What happened in the summer of 2012?
What happened in the summer of 2012 is that Mr. Rainey, who was an inmate in the TCU, which is the transitional care unit, the unit for the mentally ill, apparently defecated in his cell and refused to clean it up. The guards ordered him to clean it up, and there was a disagreement over that. Mm-hmm. And so, according to three inmate witnesses, he was marched, or he was extracted from the cell, which just means he was taken out of there by a very large guard.
Forcibly, perhaps.
Yes, yeah. Quite possibly. Marched up to a second floor shower that was apparently specifically designed for delivering a blast of excruciating hot water, and locked in there. This was a shower stall, and it's apparently the size of a closet, and he was left there for 2 hours.
What do we know about the use of that stall? Why would such a stall with scalding hot water exist in a correctional institution in America?
I was told by an inmate at the prison that it was used repeatedly to control and punish inmates, not just Darren Rainey, but others, you know, who needed to somehow be disciplined or brought in line. That was apparently discontinued the day after the Rainey incident, because we are told the day after the prison brought maintenance in and disengaged the hot water hose, so to speak.
Casey Frank with the Miami Herald, Mike Mayo with the Sun Sentinel in Broward County. I mean, you know, this was one instance that the Herald is uncovered, and then we heard about the quartet of investigators that have been looking into cases of prisoner abuse throughout the state prisoner system this week in a whistleblowing lawsuit.
Yeah, this is just a horrific, horrific tale, that this Darren Rainey instance, and that involved somebody who is a mentally ill inmate, and these inmates, it's a double whammy, because when something like this happens, it's easy to have a cover-up and to not follow up and pursue any kind of complaints, because you could say, oh, this is not only a person who's a convicted felon and a criminal, but they're also crazy. So they have basically their credibility is discounted from the start, and all you have to do is basically get two staffers or guards to corroborate a story, and then it's dismissed as being unfounded. Obviously, these things, they do happen, and now that we have these, it takes courageous whistleblowers, and I know I've talked to this George Mallinckrodt, who was a private, I guess, he worked as a psychotherapist for one of the private vendors that contract out, they get their services contracted by the state, and they work in these prisons, but these people are very fearful, because the companies just want to keep their contracts, so they don't want to make waves. And this George Mallinckrodt started to make waves. He got fired before Rainey's death, but he heard about it, and he's been also kind of trying to bring justice to Darren Rainey. And these other whistleblowers are doing the same for other incidents around the state prison system.
Steve Rothaus with the Herald.
Well, I just think that hot water, to describe this as hot water, this man's skin separated from his body. They had to clean up the skin the next day. That's how hot this was. And, you know, you hear about protests, you know, in the death penalty, on how people are put to death in this state. And yet, you know, this man was put into this closet, and he died in this closet.
Casey, what's the status of the investigation into the prisoner's death?
The status of the investigation? Well, there is a Miami-Dade police investigation that, as far as we can tell, was virtually non-existent for 2 years. Now, it picked up a bit after we began to research and write stories. And about the time our stories began to come out, the inmates who have been filing complaints up the chain, some of them obsessively for the last 2 years, finally began to be interviewed by the police department. To date, to my knowledge, none of them have ever been interviewed by the Department of Corrections. And the Department of Corrections says, we're not going to touch this until the police are done with their investigation.
Yeah.
And of course, the investigation essentially did not exist, as far as we can tell, until stories began to come out.
Has there been any discussion about an independent investigator?
No, and it's now I was not at the news conference yesterday, I believe it was.
With the secretary from the DOC, the Department of Corrections.
Correct. But at that news conference, I am told, and we reported, that the secretary said he still retains confidence in the inspector general's office. Now, that's the same inspector general's office that received complaint after complaint after complaint from inmates, also from Mr. Mallinckrodt, essentially did not investigate or closed a very brief investigation, I believe within a month of the incident.
And one of the claims in the whistleblower lawsuit that we saw this week was misleading, perhaps even a kind of under-the-rug investigation of a death of an inmate in the panhandle at a correctional facility up there. Casey Frank is with the Miami Herald, Steve Rothaus with the Herald, and Mike Mayo with the South Florida Sun Sentinel. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Bob joins us from Jupiter. Go ahead, Bob. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. Go ahead with your thoughts.
Okay. Back in the 80s, the state of Tennessee and New York State, coincidentally, set up programs to have psych assessments of corrections officers, and I set up the program in Tennessee and ran it for a few years. What it does is saves money for the state because people that don't stay on the job a year or more can be ferreted out. Antisocial behavior potential can be taken care of, so you can cut the amount of misbehavior of corrections officers by doing an assessment, a psychological assessment, psych testing plus a structured interview, and weed out many of the potential bad actors. So it's a no-brainer to take care of at least some of the problems, and our state at this point is, I don't think, looking in that direction, and I wish they would.
Bob, do you work with the Department of Corrections on these kinds of assessments?
No, I'm retired, and I have been in contact with them. I've been suggesting some policies, programs, giving them some background information that would help them make the decision, but I haven't heard from them.
Bob from Jupiter joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Casey, what do we know about hiring practices? Have those come under under a cloud of suspicion, under inquisition, so to speak, with these cases?
In truth, we've heard nothing about hiring practices. And I have to say that the Department of Corrections does not answer our questions, with the exception of yesterday's news conference. But they do invite us to submit records requests, and we do, and they fulfill them to some extent. We're in court as we speak now, trying to get a little more help ferreting out information, but we do know that they have announced a couple of sort of tweaks to policies. They're reviewing the way in which mentally ill inmates are handled within the prison system, and they are also going to be henceforth steering all criminal investigations of inmate deaths to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement rather than to, in this case, a local police department.
Casey Frank with the Miami Herald covering investigations into the Department of Corrections here in South Florida as well as statewide. Steve Rothaus with the Herald and Mike Mayo with the South Florida Sun Sentinel. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup. We will have more on the big sports announcement. LeBron James making it official through a first-person essay in Sports Illustrated that he will return to Cleveland and, quote, finish my career there. In the meantime, two South Florida judges have decisions of their own to make, one in the Keys and one in Miami, ruling soon on two gay marriage cases. In the Keys, two bartenders, Aaron Huntsman and William Jones, had a commitment ceremony 10 years ago. Back in April, they applied for a marriage license in Monroe County, and they were denied. Attorneys for the county clerk and the state attorney general's office offered brief defenses in court this month. The longest argument to uphold the ban on gay marriage came from Matthew Staver of Orlando, an attorney with Liberty Counsel.
Place after place, it's had a negative impact on marriage, it's had a negative impact on children, it has a negative impact on religious freedom, people that have a moral opposition to same-sex marriage.
In Miami-Dade County, Melanie Elaner and her partner Vanessa are among the half-dozen couples who sued in January for the right to marry.
We live in Florida. We have a son. We've been together for almost 9 years. So I think that the judge is going to see that.
We're waiting for those judges to rule in those two cases. Steve Rothaus with the Miami Herald. Those rulings could come at any moment.
Any moment. We're waiting for any kind of signal from either Monroe County or from Miami-Dade County in the two cases. The cases mirror each other. Essentially, you have six couples in Miami-Dade County who are requesting the right to marry. Here in Miami-Dade County, they've sued the clerk, Harvey Rubin.
Right, because the clerk is the one that gives out the marriage license,
correct.
Or in this case, denied the marriage licenses.
And the clerk's office is not actively defending the lawsuit. The clerk's office is saying through its lawyers that essentially they will do whatever they're told to do, and that leaves it to the state to defend the case. Matthew Staver's group and some of the others asked to be defendants in the case, but the judges in both Miami-Dade County and in the Keys rejected their motions.
What do we know about the range of outcomes that these county judges could rule?
Well, I mean, the first thing that either judge could do would be to say, we will not grant your motion today. The case will go to trial. Essentially, what the plaintiffs have done in both counties is to ask each judge to make a summary judgment to immediately impose upon the state that these people have the right to marry. So that would be a possible outcome in either of the counties would the judges say, no, we'll go to trial, we'll hash it all out mm-hmm. in court, and at the end of the trial, we will decide what to do. But the other options they have would be to say, you know, you're right, you do have the right to marry, and then order the clerk to issue marriage licenses.
Mike Mayo with the South Florida Sun-Sentinel. These are constitutional cases here in the state of Florida, thanks to a 2008 constitutional amendment that the majority of Floridians voted and approved, which defined marriage that would exclude gay marriage. That does exclude gay marriage.
Right, and this we have an essential conflict in a democracy where we have basically the will of the voters putting something into the Constitution which inherently might be unconstitutional, because how do you violate the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution and some other fundamental basic human rights as outlined in our Constitution and Declaration of Independence by kind of putting up basic rights to a public vote? And if in the 1950s, if you put up maybe civil rights or mixed racial marriages up to a public vote, I don't know if they would have passed. They probably wouldn't have. But it's just seen as fundamentally wrong and antithetical to what we're founded on as a society. And so that's what these judges are here to do. And it's a big decision. Yes, the voters voted one way in 2008, but I think fundamentally it's just wrong.
Well, we've also seen a sea change in attitudes, even since 2008.
In public attitudes
concerning gay marriage. Back in 2008, nearly 62% of the public voted to add a constitutional amendment that would limit marriage to one man, one woman. Since then, polling has shown that up to 58% of the public now support letting gay people marry. But the problem is that there is a 60% threshold in order to change the Constitution. So where in 2008, 62% said change it, today, if that number were reduced and 58% of the public said we support this, it's still not enough to remove that portion of the Constitution.
It's amazing to me how fast public opinion has shifted on this issue. And I think so many people, especially in the younger generation, get it, that when two people of either gender are in love with each other, what is it the state's business to impede on having them form a safe, loving family? And if people who are really supposedly about family values are about family values, they should support marriage between two human beings in any way, shape, or form.
And we've seen, guys, time and time again where it is a local judge, county judges, state-level judges that have stepped in front of state laws or state constitutional amendments and put an end to defining marriage as one woman, one man. I mean, Steve, we've seen this in many, many states where it does begin with a real small jurisdiction judge that winds up going against what the state policy is and gets argued up to the state court. And quite frequently, we've seen constitutional amendments like those here in Florida wind up being overturned.
Well, there have been 23 victories by gay marriage advocates since the Supreme Court ruling in June of 2013 that threw out much of the Defense of Marriage Act, the Federal Marriage Act, which allowed Edie Windsor to be able to claim her marriage to her partner and then not have to pay the taxes to the IRS after the partner died.
And I think we should note this also, besides this local effort at the county level, there's another track that's being pursued in federal court by the American Civil Liberties Union, which is those cases involving people who are legally married of the same sex in other states don't have those marriages recognized in Florida. And that is completely unequal as opposed to heterosexual couples who get married in New York or elsewhere. They come down here and their marriages are recognized by the state.
Right. Exactly. And that was Section 2 of the Defense of Marriage Act, which the Supreme Court did not address. The Supreme Court last year only ruled on Section 3, which was the section of DOMA that told the federal government that it could not recognize these marriages. Section 2 of Defense of Marriage Act is the part that gave the states the right to not recognize marriages performed elsewhere.
Steve Rothaus with the Miami Herald, Mike Mayo with the South Florida Sun Sentinel. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup. Scott joins the program from North Miami. Scott, go ahead. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on. My partner and I got married in Washington, D.C., and I'm wondering, if the judge rules to allow marriages to go forward in Florida, what would that mean for my marriage?
So this would be a marriage that was done outside the Florida jurisdiction, Steve Rothaus, depending upon what the judges rule in Miami-Dade County. Scott lives in North Miami.
Right. Well, there's an assumption, and it's not clear, but that if the judge in Dade County, Miami-Dade County, rules that the constitutional amendment is unconstitutional, that your marriage will be valid in Miami-Dade County.
Could he remarry again in this state? Is there any law against remarrying the same person twice in different states?
Yeah, I mean, he wouldn't have to, and the fact is
because it would already be recognized as a legal marriage.
The federal
marriage.
Government recognizes the marriage. And
but
all
the
other
of Florida
states
does not.
Right,
right,
exactly. Right. If he got married in New York, his marriage would be recognized in Washington, D.C., and it would be recognized in California, right, Massachusetts, or any of the other states that recognize marriage. But it's not recognized here. The judge's ruling could influence whether or not it would be recognized in the county.
Finally, Steve, is there any clock ticking on either judge to rule, any pressure to rule, any deadline that they
Absolutely
have to abide
none.
By?
Absolutely none. The judges can take as much time as they'd like to be able to issue a ruling. There is some discussion that if a judge wanted to be the judge to open up gay marriage in Florida, that they would probably do it sooner than later, and that they would probably want to do it to give people time to actually get married before a stay would be issued.
Steve Rothaus with the Miami Herald, Mike Mayo with the South Florida Sun Sentinel. I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup. Stay close. Plenty more to come, including the indecision is over for South Florida, LeBron James, and the future in the NBA. Next on the Florida Roundup. The Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. 4 years ago, LeBron James told the world he was taking his talents to South Beach. Today, he says, I'm coming home. He's leaving Miami and leaving the Heat and leaving South Florida NBA fans to return home to the Cleveland Cavaliers, making the statement in an exclusive Sports Illustrated first-person essay titled, I'm Coming Home. Join the conversation about LeBron's decision to leave Miami, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Tim Padgett covers the Americas for us here on WLRN. Mike Mayo from the South Florida Sun Sentinel, Casey Frank with the Miami Herald, and Steve Rothaus with the Miami Herald all joining us. Mike Mayo, surprised by this decision and surprised in the method in which LeBron communicates this. He writes, I'm not going to have a press conference or a party after this. It's time to get to work.
No, and I think after the last time, after he was harshly rebuked for having the big press conference and milking the moment and breaking the hearts of Cleveland, this time he wanted to be more low-key, and everybody was on him for indecision, but that's just because we're in this hyperspace, internet-driven world. The earliest he could have signed anywhere was yesterday. He took a day to ponder, to talk. I think he already had his mind made up, but he just wanted to kind of sleep on it. And I think all the indications were he was leaning this way, and then he announced it in this way through a personal essay posted on SI.com.
Mm-hmm.
Us down here in Miami, obviously, we're disappointed. I'm not going to be bitter. I respect him. He's unbelievably talented. I'm appreciative for the 4 years that he spent down here. And what I just posted on a tweet is King James wants to become Messiah James, because if he wins a title for the long-suffering fans of Cleveland, whose any sports teams up there haven't won anything since the early 60s, mm-hmm. he will be regarded as the man and the Messiah up there. And that's what he wants to do. He's already won his titles for himself. Now he wants to burnish his legacy by winning it for the fans of Cleveland.
Tim Padgett, he writes, I'm coming home. He says, before anyone ever cared where I would play basketball, I was a kid from Northeast Ohio. He makes a very personal argument, almost not directly to the fans of the Miami Heat, but certainly a portion of the audience that this essay is directed toward.
Well, which is all very well and good, but I think a lot of Miamians, when they start digesting this, are going to find it a little disingenuous. I mean, the argument he makes there that I had to spend 4 years in Miami to become the man who now realizes that it's time to go back home. It's a nice sentiment, but I think a lot of Miamians over time are going to find it to be, as I said, a little disingenuous.
Yeah, Steve Rothhaus, he writes, without the experiences I had there, meaning Miami, I wouldn't be able to do what I'm doing today. Left unsaid is leaving Miami for Cleveland for the maximum contract that he can get under the NBA salary cap rules. This is a market economy, after all.
Well, I mean, this essay didn't just get written this morning. I mean, this is very carefully crafted and very carefully worded, so that, you know, he is really putting as good a spin on this as he possibly can, and he is returning to, you know, Ohio, and he'll be the local hero again. And he won't have to prove anything, at least at first. They'll just be happy to have him back, particularly the way he's phrased all of this.
Are you sad to see LeBron go? Are you angry at the way that his decision has played out here to leave the Miami Heat after 4 years, 4 championship runs, 2 NBA championships in 4 years, 4 final appearances? Let us know here on the Florida Roundup at 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLR. Casey Frank in Miami, and certainly downtown Miami with the AAA arena, but really throughout South Florida, LeBron had become an economy of his own. This was somebody who clearly brought the world focus to Miami and Miami sports. This brought higher ticket revenue, certainly for the AAA and for the Miami Heat ownership, but didn't necessarily profit for the people of Miami-Dade County in terms of the kinds of deals that happened with the AAA being a county facility.
Well, that's true, but I think that's true of stadiums and arenas all over the country, and it's nothing new, and we know that to be the case. My frame of reference on this is as a lifelong Cubs fan. you know, we have not won a World Series in the course of my life.
1908, right?
In the course of my forebears' life, lives, and we're not about to win one anytime soon. This guy came here, gave 4 years, won 2 titles. He owes nothing. He delivered what he promised. And
he did say not one, not two, not three, not four. Actually, it was just 2. But okay.
Well, okay, he owes us 2.
but no, to echo his sentiments, he doesn't owe us anything. And you know what? South Florida is not for everyone. We all know people. Some of us come here and stay for life, like me. And I know a lot of people, colleagues, who come in here and after 1 or 2 years and say, you know what? I'm getting out of here. Now, I don't know. I think LeBron personally liked it, but what I'm hearing is maybe some of his family members in the inner circle wasn't enamored as much. And again, you know, we're hearing all the noise about some peripheral issues about how maybe his people in his inner circle weren't treated the same way by the Heat organization and given the same kind of run of the place as he did in Cleveland. But whatever it is, he made his decision. I wish him good luck, and I am just appreciative for the time that we had watching him and these teams here in Miami, and I'm not going to be bitter.
Cheryl joins the program from Miami. Cheryl, I take it you're a bit disappointed. Are you bitter by the decision?
I'm disappointed in the way I think he handled the leaving. Again, obviously, this article wasn't written last night. I think, you know, to keep us hanging in suspense is not nice. I think we've treated him well. He didn't fulfill all of his promises to us. But, again, I am appreciative of what he did while he's here. I wish him good luck. But I think he could have handled this leaving again better.
All right, Cheryl, thank you for your thoughts. Barry is joining us from Cutler Bay. Barry, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think this is this decision is strictly all about LeBron and only about LeBron. There's no loyalty there to his younger fans, especially the kids that look up to him.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that, Barry, and thanks again for your comments, because he does write in this essay talking about just that, talking about younger fans and talking about the way that Cleveland reacted 4 years ago when he left, burning of the jerseys and those kinds of things. In fact, we have a tweet from One Love Poet saying, "Won't be burning jerseys a la Cleveland style, that's for darn sure," in regards to the reaction expected here in South Florida. But LeBron, in his first-person essay, talks about his mixed emotions in terms of returning to Cleveland. He writes, "Then you think about the other side. What if I were a kid who looked up to an athlete and that athlete made me want to do better in my life and then he left?" To Barry's point, what about those young athletes here in South Florida that he's leaving?
Yeah, and that is terribly disappointing. I've got an 8-year-old girl who has a LeBron jersey, and as soon as she heard the words opt out 3 weeks ago, she says, "This means I have to throw away my LeBron jersey."
Opt out meant throw out, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
And but you know what? For the grown-ups out here, I think if he had left to L.A. or New York or to try to take it to a major media market and kind of milk that even more, then I would say we have every right to be bitter. But because this is kind of a homecoming and kind of completing unfinished business and showing that he can make amends or that he's willing to forgive and forget all the ugliness of 4 years ago, including that letter written by the Cleveland Cavaliers owner, it shows that he is kind of a man. And this is the only place that he could have gone that he could kind of, even though we're disappointed now, you kind of maybe say, okay, I respect that.
No, I mean, I think that what he says, I mean, I don't particularly consider it to be disingenuous. I mean, he says in the essay, "My presence can make a difference in Miami, but I think it can mean more from where I'm from. I want kids in Northeast Ohio, like the hundreds of Akron third graders I sponsor through my phone foundation, to realize there's no better place to grow up." And, you know, I say, you know, more power to him for that.
Yeah, but I think South Florida has learned a lesson from this, too. I mean, that's all great. And he did give us 4 great years. And I do respect what you just pointed out about what he wants to do for Northeast Ohio. But I think the lesson we've learned here also, I mean, I wrote this week about how Brazil has this, you know, inordinate obsession with soccer. And I think this also points out our inordinate obsession with overpaid athletes and how we just let them lead us around by the nose, as this drama this week that we went through shows.
Well, yeah, we'll continue. We made them kings.
Exactly.
That's right. That's right.
And I have one more question. Does anybody want to buy a pair of Heat tickets?
A pair of Heat tickets for sale. That's right. Mike Mayo with the South Florida Sun Sentinel, Casey Frank with the Miami Herald, Tim Padgett with WLRN, our America's editor, and Steve Rothaus with the Miami Herald. Thank you, all of you.
Can I just say one thing? I've got a big project coming out in Sunday's paper. It's called Driven. It's about a guy who has to decide between being a doctor or a NASCAR driver. He's a Harvard grad, a University of Miami medical student, and he has to decide whether to follow his head or his heart.
We look for that for Sunday in the South Florida Sun Sentinel by Mike Mayo. I'm Tom Hudson. The conversation continues on Twitter, lamenting or enjoying the leaving of LeBron James at WLRN. The Florida Roundup here on this Friday, produced by Elaine Shannon and Alicia Zuckerman, our technical supervisor, Paul Leary. I'm Tom Hudson. Stay tuned. South Florida Arts Beat with Ed Bell is next. Thanks for listening.